I'm Hanif Abdurraqib. Join me on Tuesday, May 30th for a special live edition of my podcast, Small Joys. I'll be interviewing artist and writer Regan Buchanan about her new comic book, The Secret History of Black Punk. And, of course, we'll discuss what brings her joy. This is a free event that includes refreshments, the podcast recording, and a Q&A session too. Register at wosu.org/events to reserve your seat. Support for this live show comes from the Columbus Foundation.
Support for Small Joys comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating the creativity that inspires and strengthens the Central Ohio community every day. More at columbusfoundation.org. Support also comes from the Greater Columbus Arts Council's Columbus Makes Art.
WOSU Public Media, this is Small Joys, and I'm Hanif Abdurraqib. Today, my guest is April Tsunami. April is a mixed media artist and painter whose work focuses on the female form, specifically bold depictions of Black women. Her work has been widely exhibited in galleries and museums, including the Columbus Museum of Art and the National African American Museum. Also, if you live in Columbus, you have almost certainly seen some of her work on buildings, on murals. I drive past one such mural on the way back to my house almost every day. April and I began our conversation talking about the depiction of Black women in art and how that has changed over time. The evolution of the depiction of Black women in art, it feels like there was an arc where these depictions perhaps were not either as layered or expansive as, or robust as I'd remembered them being when I was young, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what I really love about your art is just the sheer size, scope, and kind of tactile expansiveness of it. Be it with like materials or the specifics of the of both faces and hair and clothing, I'm kind of interested if you view your practice, your artistic practice, as a mode of correction, or if you're not even thinking about that at all when you're in process.
It absolutely is. I say this all the time. Actually, my background is in art history,
right?
And just throughout all the things that I studied, I didn't see many depictions or mention of the presence of Black people in art, especially Black women. And so, my art sought to fix that in a certain sense. So, yeah, I'm just, nowadays I see so much more. I see a proliferation of people who do work similar to mine and are interested in inserting Black bodies in the canon. And I'm glad to be a part of that.
Do you feel more comfortable working in terms of scale? Do you feel more comfortable kind of working to larger scale? Are you, because it feels like, I ask this because your pieces are both, the pieces that I love yours that I see and really I'm drawn to are the larger ones, kind of larger scale things. But I think I'm drawn to them and I love them because even in your larger scale work, it's like several small pieces harmonizing, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm also interested in your process of that kind of art making. Like, do you see yourself when you take on a larger art project? For example, like in my brain, if I'm writing a 5,000 word piece, I don't think about it as a 5,000 word piece. I tend to think, well, I got to write 500 words 10 times and kind of braid them together. In terms of working to scale, is there a difference in approach or is it all kind of the same?
To me, I say this. I think a smaller piece takes as much time and attention as a larger piece in a lot of ways. I think if you have a 5,000 page piece or a gigantic mural to do, it's obviously more intimidating, and it takes a lot of it takes a lot of rigor to finish it. But I kind of think about both of them. Kind of weirdly, I think that they are both the same amount of effort. I don't know if that makes sense, you know?
No, like, That makes sense. You traveled semi-recently, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were in Senegal, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first time hitting the continent, or had you been before?
No, that was my first time. Yeah, it's so weird. I've always talked about, going somewhere to West Africa, Ghana or, Sierra Leone or Senegal. And it was just, oh, man. I mean, I just talk about a transformational trip. I know it sounds like, this is going to sound so cliche, but I was watching a video the other day, on YouTube, and it was just like, just a traveler just kind of going through the streets of Dakar. And I don't know, again, it's going to sound so goofy and cliche, but I just felt this like pang in my heart. I just felt this like weird pang. And I said that I feel homesick. I know that's like so cliche. I'm not from there. I have no family there. I have no, I have no actual connection to the place. But I just really, I do. I have a connection, emotional connection.
Yeah.
But I guess that's it. I just got such an emotional connection. Have you been?
I have not. It's a goal of mine. I would like to go to Senegal or South Africa. I have had these like goals for a long time, but I also just don't really love international travels.
I get
which
that.
Which is like ridiculous, honestly. But I think as I get older and I know that I'm not, Lord willing, I have many years left, but still, as I get older and as I have the means to do it, there's a part of me that's kind of like, well, it might be time.
Yeah.
The time might be now.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like also curious about how that impacted your art from a, even just from the standpoint of colors that you were returning to. I don't know if you're someone whose choice of colors and choice of kind of templates and inspirations changes based off of experience or spirituality or feeling. These kind of, was there a shift at all? Did you see a shift at all in what you were creating upon your return?
Oh my God, I'm so glad you asked that question. I do. I think that like, every place that you go to, you can see if you go to galleries in Florida or California, there's a certain palette to every place, a way that you think about light, the way you think about color. And I will never forget Fioris West, who was a professor of painting at Ohio State many years ago, and a mentor to me. He had a show years ago at the Fort Hayes. It was a beautiful solo show. And I'm also willing to say he's a pioneer in Afrofuturism and Afro-surrealism, but I don't want to digress. But anyway, he was telling me that he showed me these two paintings he had side by side. One was a painting of something he did in his basement studio in Columbus, Ohio, and it was like this kind of a dark, it was a beautiful piece, but the palette was really dark and had a lot of purples, and it looked like nighttime. And then he showed me what he did after he went to West Africa, and I can't remember exactly what country he went to. And you could see the difference. It was so palpable. It was just like everything was just gold. Everything was just bathed in golden light. And so to be honest, I was influenced by that. So I was prepped to see that for sure when I went to Senegal. I don't know as of yet, like if I have like truly like mastered that sense of light and color at all in my work. But the thought is there, I'm conscious of it for sure.
Yeah. What does mastery look like or feel like to you in that sense? If we're talking about light and color, like how does one, it's easy for me, for example, to think about this in terms of writing and understanding, honing craft and how that shows up on the page. But I feel like when we're talking about light and color and, that feels, and I'm sure this is just to me as someone who is not at all a visual artist, but that feels a little more vague, though I'm sure it does not too. Like, how do you work towards that mastery, and then how do you know when you have arrived?
I kind of feel like in order to like really master it, I feel like I have to be there longer. Know what I mean? Like, I have to be in that space longer to really be on the wavelength of the place and like really understand and to really like understand the palette of a place. I think the palette is intertwined with just everything, like the whole vibe of a place. It's intertwined with the, it's intertwined with everything. I think every place kind of has a, you know, kind of, it does. Every place has a wavelength, and it takes some time to get on it. And I think in order to master something like color, you have to be there a little bit longer. Or maybe that's an excuse for me.
I think that makes sense. That makes sense.
And this is going back at this point like a year. But I love New People, the show New People. And I remember being like not really feeling great and then seeing that work and feeling that it was like kind of teeming with a kind of optimism in a way, or teeming with a kind of, I've been trying to get away from the word joy as a broad descriptor.
I love joy. Yeah, let's go with
that. Okay. Let's go with that. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if it was too, I didn't want to kind of cut off the work that was happening in New People, but I think it has been, or it's proven difficult to access optimism at a rate that I think I need to in order to sustain myself, not just my work. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about how you tapped into that to make that body of work, and if that has sustained, or was that just kind of like a, I did this really massive, beautiful thing, and now I am less optimistic, or has that optimism lived in you since you've kind of walked away from that?
First of all, I'm glad that you got that, you know, that you kind of got, like, that was the optimism and something spiritual and joyful was, like, that was the goal of what I was trying to get to with that. I did this series, I think I started in 2019. It was called The Power Series, and it was, like, black and gold, and, you know, it was also coming out of, it was just some rough years, you know. And so there was a bit of defiance, I'll just go ahead and say anger and defiance and anger that is kind of beneath the surface of those pieces. And so New People was an attempt to figure out, like, what's on the other side of that? Where would I like for all of us to be? And so I was just like, well, I want to, like, abandon this, like, black and gold palette. And, like, I got all these, like, iridescent papers, gotten the crystals, and, you know, and so that was the foundation of New People. And what was wild about New People was in the process of creating it, my mother passed. And I'm, like, grieving. And I have this idea of, like, what does it mean to get to the other side of something? So it became, like, really personal, you know? It became this this cathartic process. Like, I made a majority of those pieces right after she passed. I just kind of sequestered myself in my studio, didn't talk to anybody, and made that work. And so in a lot of ways, though, it was just, I'm glad I did it. I feel like now, I still want to keep that joy. I still want to keep that optimism. But I don't know. I'm not sure if it's going to present is like, I don't know, as shiny and as I don't think it's going to present like New People.
Yeah. Yeah. As someone who dabbles heavily in the understanding of not even working through grief, but working towards a place where you are comfortable or at some level of peace with your grief kind of living with you, that puts a whole new lens on that work. So thank you. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, particularly because I think why I try to get away from joy as a broad descriptor, even though I also do love joy, is because of something you said, this thing about, like, well, these pieces were also born out of kind of rage, also born out of kind of sadness, and joy is the end result of that. But the journey for that work is great. And so, and with that in mind, I also love that your portrayals of black women are almost always, or if I mean literally always, women who are not particularly tied to trauma or celebrated for their ability to endure trauma. And when I was talking about the arc of Black women in art, I do think there was a stretch for me where it was challenging because, you know, and I find this in my research thinking about and writing about Black women musicians and performers, so much of their story, so much of the story of, say, a Billie Holiday or even a Whitney Houston is tied to what they endured and then tied to the tragedies that they endured or did not endure.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, really narrows the realities of how singularly gifted these folks were. And I'm assuming that your approach to this kind of uprooting of trauma and then presenting someone independent of trauma is intentional. But do you see, again, to talk about that kind of corrective, do you see that approach having an impact on how you personally, as a person independent of the art, views the world and views Black women in your community?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the pain, the struggle is there, but I feel like we have enough complex stories, you know? I mean, that's not true. Let me backtrack that. I don't feel like we have enough complex stories, but we have enough that does. It focuses on trauma. And I want to be a part of, you know, just showing the joy, showing abundance, showing, you know, what's beautiful about, you know, living in the skin, inhabiting the skin. I just recently had this conversation that kind of made me think of it. I was talking to my kids and I was like, hey, it's Black History Month. And I'm turning my wheels and thinking about, you know, all the movies we're going to see together. And, you know, it just kind of opened up this conversation about how, you know, just a lot of things that we consume are, you know, is so rooted in that. It's so much, very much the story is rooted in you know, pain and suffering and oppression. And so, yeah, I definitely was very conscious in my art about presenting a different story than that. I also was very interested in, because, you know, I think about, when we think about Black history, especially the way I was, you know, growing up and the way it was presented to me in school, it always started here, you know, in America. It always started with, you know,
my enslaved folks. Yeah.
Right. My enslaved ancestors. And so, you know, my inquiry was like, what was beyond that? And so I guess that's how this connection with Africa began, you know, just kind of learning about what that history looked like before colonization. And, you know, it blows my mind to think, you know, there are more pyramids in Sudan than there are in Egypt.
Right.
And, you know, any number of things like that. But there's, yeah, just great empires and there's greatness there. And that's just something that was completely omitted. So that's part of it. I just kind of also wanted to show there's so much more. There's so much more than what we're being seen, you know, shown. So much more. I'm hoping that, I don't know, I'm hoping that changes, but, you know, of course.
Yeah. I'm interested because my ears perked up and it was like, I was talking to my kids about what movies we're going to watch during Black History Month, because that my parents were on that too, you know, parents were like, and I'm interested in, one, was that something, is that a tradition passed down through generations, or is this kind of a thing where you're like, you know, if I got my kid, you know, my kids are going to know, you know, we're going to watch this, but I'm also interested in what y'all are watching.
Well, you know, I'm so upset. What we did watch in the past was Your Attention, Please. It's on Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
With Craig Robinson. Like, I love that show. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, let's get some different narratives in here. You know, like, growing up, I watched Roots, you know, and I felt like an obligation to show my children Roots, you know, because I watched it. And my kids are thoroughly, you know, traumatized by it. But, you know, it is. It's a part of the story. So, we've gotten through a little bit of that. That's what
Roots is wild. It's so wild to me that the age, I was so young when I watched Roots, mm-hmm. and I know, and I don't. This is not begrudging. Like I think it's, you know, I don't know. It's important to watch Roots, I think, but I remember being so young and being that kid who was like going to school the next day, both angry and incredibly traumatized. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
It's also just a lot to add. You know, it's like a lot to ask of. I mean, Roots is very long.
Yeah,
very very long.
You got to break it up. You got to,
you can't do it all in one.
Oh, no, it's not a marathon. You watch it. Well, that's the thing. You know, you designate a day, you're going to watch something and you spread it out and, you know, you get through it that way. But, my kids are just like, no. You know what I mean? Like, they are so, disconnected from it. They are not feeling it. And I get it. I get it. But it's, you know, it's a real story. And you know, it's all of our story, really.
Truly. Do you count yourself as someone who's a bit reclusive? I ask mostly because I can't tell as I like age as an artist and a person. I can't tell if, like, I just never liked going out or I do my, you know what I mean? Like,
I can't tell
if I just do my best work in a mindset that trends towards reclusiveness and I didn't notice it until now, or if I'm just kind of like, oh, I think I'm a recluse. And that's just, you know, and I'm not without shame, you know, like comfortable mm-hmm. with that. But mm-hmm. I think I'm wondering now if it's something that I've denied myself for so long. And so many of artists that I know and love, so many of our homies here in the city, I think are so good at being out in the world. I'm thinking about Scott Woods in particular, who is very good at being out in the world, but I think by nature, he is also reclusive and, mm-hmm. you know, Duarte, like all these folks who are good outside, but are probably better in the comforts of their own space. And so my brain has been kind of running through that lately. And I'm wondering if you find yourself growing ever reclusive as you get more comfortable and settled in your art practice, or if you are just like, I've always been reclusive, this is what I've always been.
Yeah, I'll say this. I mean, I'm just very socially awkward. You know, there's a lot of anxiety for me.
Yes.
Just being out in social spaces. And the thing is like, I really like people, you know, like I love seeing people out in our community and it feels good. I feel restored, but I'm also a huge introvert. I think I'm happiest when I'm by myself, I'm in my studio and I'm making stuff. That's the truth of it. I am. I'm happiest in my studio, but I'm also happy when I get out and, you know, I see my people, but I'd rather be alone if I had to pick. Yeah, that's the
yeah. What is next for you in terms of what you're building towards and what you're working on in the moment?
Oh gosh, that's such a good question. I definitely feel like I'm kind of under construction. You know, I've just mm-hmm. really been questioning a lot of. Kind of, you know, what I've been doing. I mean, I've been kind of working in the same vein for 15, 16 years now, which is cool. You know, it's been a framework for me to kind of explore a lot. But I don't know. I'm also exploring, like, what does it mean to move on from that? It's a very weird space to be in, where my husband calls it the wheel of creativity. I couldn't even begin to explain it, but he says you're on the cycle. You're back on the cycle of like creativity, where you know, there's these like steps when that you have to like reach into, you master something or whatever. But I feel like I guess I'm on this like wheel of kind of starting over creatively. I think right now I'm in the process of learning. I'm just trying to, I feel like you can never, I feel like you can never be good enough. You know, I don't know. That's like, that's driving. Like, I feel like I'm still just trying to learn and still trying to master so much. And also just trying to figure out like how can I make art that really, really says what I want to say, you know, and it can be less about having an impact, or it can be less about social practice, but work that I want to do.
How are you in this process of kind of transition of sorts, particularly, you know, if you're talking about a practice and a commitment that has been ongoing for a decade and a half and then transitioning? How are you kind of grounding yourself? Like, what kind of pleasures are you finding outside of art to recharge yourself in the process of moving through art? Like, I think another thing about winter with me is I always find myself like, oh man, I'm so rigorous about getting away from my work at a certain time. Mm-hmm. But when winter hits, it's like I look up and it's like 7 p.m. and I'm still typing away. And I, you know, it's mm-hmm. one of those things. And so what are you doing to kind of renew your individual joyful self in the midst of all the work?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm still trying to figure that out. You know, this is weird. I need a hobby. I really do. I need a hobby. Like, I do. Like, work, you know, I don't know. You can tell me if you relate, but, you know, we both work in creative fields. So our work is creative, you know, and that feeds our creative spirit. And it's not a hobby. It's our profession.
Right.
So,
right.
But like, I don't know. I don't know what I do for fun. I really don't.
It is so easy for the, I mean, working in a creative field, it's so easy for the work to veer into feeling like a hobby, you know, because, you know, if you're fortunate, you enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you're fortunate, you enjoy what you're doing and you're, you know, there's gratitude for it, all that.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm always having to convince myself and remind myself, like, just because I'm having a good time here doesn't mean it can be the only time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a good time with the work, but I tend to think a hobby can be just like the smallest thing, you know? It can be enjoying listening to a record for a few hours, not a few hours, but I grant myself at least an hour. These kind of things, you know? Because, yeah, for me, it's when I love what I'm writing, when I love what I'm working on, that's when I really fall, I get into trouble. Because it's like, this is fulfilling all my needs,
mm-hmm.
Which it might be in the moment, but that's the trick. That's the trick of loving, you know, loving the pursuits that we do, which is a blessing in one way, but surely a curse of sorts in another way.
I feel that. I still have to figure that out. I like to clean.
I also like to clean. I was actually this morning, I had the dishes that piled up because I've been away. And I was like, just spent like 45 minutes doing, like really doing the dishes well, you know?
Yeah.
I have a dishwasher, but I don't use it. You know, I just kind of like.
Oh, by hand.
Yeah, I just love the, there is something about cleaning that I really, which is wild. Because when I was a kid, you literally couldn't pay me to clean. Like my parents would try to pay me to clean and I just wouldn't do it. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is now, but cleaning is a quiet, peaceful space.
What's something you can see like a result? You know what I mean? It's
absolutely.
In one state and then it's like, you know, boom, here's the finished product. Here's your, you know, the manifestation of all your labors is here and you get to enjoy this space, you know, you get to enjoy these.
That's
clean
absolutely
dishes.
Why I love it, because it's like it's a clean, clear cut, like point A to point B. And there's not a lot of variation between the result. Like I feel like if I sit down and write and I've dreamed up something, or if you sit down to like paint something you dreamed up, there's a lot of different ways it could end. All of them could be good ways. But there's a lot of different ways it could end outside of how you envision it. If I see a sink full of dishes, there's kind of like only one way that, and you know what I mean? Like if I clean the dishes, the sink will be empty. And that's the end. That's the end that I'm looking for. And that's the end I'm going to get. So there's a satisfaction too in that, like the variation of what can happen. It's narrow.
And it's also like not, there's no emotional attachment to it. Like, I don't know, do you feel like with your work, like, you know what I mean? Like if it turns out well or it doesn't, there's still like an emotional attachment to it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, like with cleaning there's none of that. You like, you get it done or you don't and you move on. And
you
it's not
on
that
the
way.
Next thing.
It's not that way with like writing your art. Like you're just, you know, it's an existential crisis if something goes wrong, you know, with that. But
This has been illuminating. I hope. April, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I'm really rooting for you to find a hobby. I feel like that sentence probably comes out a bit harsher than intended, but no, genuinely, I'm rooting for you to find something that fulfills you outside of, or in, not even outside of, but like in concert with
mm-hmm.
the work you create, because I think what I love about your work is that it feels so in harmony with the world and with kind of a broader and ever-flowing spirituality in relationship with the world. And so whatever your hobby is, I hope that it is in concert with the work you create.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I hope I find that hobby too.
All right. Thank you, April. Hopefully I'll see you out in the world soon.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to the Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
At the end of every episode, I take some time to share one of my small joys. And another dog-centered one that is a little simple and short is that yesterday being Sunday, May 7th, not when you hear this, was my dog Wendy's birthday, and she turned 7 years old. And that's always a delight. It's always a delight to reflect on the time that we spent together, which is 4 years now. I got her when she was three, and I've kind of, to chart our time together through her birthdays has been fascinating, particularly since a large amount of the time we spent together has been through the pandemic. It's just been a delight to kind of see her grow into the dog that she is now, which is a bolder, more braver dog than she was when we found each other. And I think that she has had that impact on me. I've gotten to grow into a more bold and brave and less anxious person because I've gotten to be witness to her brilliance and her generosity and her fearlessness and being loved by the world and being in love with the world. And so that is a small joy that continues to echo for me today. Before we end the show today, I want to make sure people know about the special live Small Joys coming up on May 30th. My guest will be the talented artist Regan Buchanan. We'll talk about the release of her new comic book, The Secret History of Black Punk, and much more. This is a free event, but registration is required. You can do that by going to wosu.org/events for more information. Small Joys is a production of WOSU Public Media and part of the NPR network. The show is produced and edited by Michael DeBonis, sound engineering by Eric French. Nick Hauser is the Chief Content Director of Digital Media. Thanks to Leticia Wiggins for editorial support, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and we'll be back next week with more Small Joys.